This is the Financial Exchange with Chuck Zotta and Mike Armstrong. Your exclusive look at business and financial news affecting your day, your city, your world. Stay informed and up to date about economic and market trends, plus breaking business news every day. This is the Financial Exchange with Chuck Zotta and Mike Armstrong.
Let's go stocks. Yeah. Let's go stocks. Well,
it's less bad.
They're going somewhere.
Yeah.
It's not up. It's Chuck, Mike, and Matt with you today. Tucker is, I don't know what Tucker's doing exactly, but he's not here.
Apple picking. I'm just making things up. I don't really know. I'm going apple picking. It's apple picking season.
We're
going
to talk a little bit about apple picking later in the show, but that can't be our top story on a day where you've got every major index down over 1.25% to this point. In fact, the NASDAQ down 1.75%, S&P down 1.5%, Dow off 1.4%. I say it in percentage points because you wouldn't like me very much if I said, hey guys, the Dow is off 450 points. Hey, the S&P's off 60. The NASDAQ's off 260. You wouldn't like me if I said those numbers. Percentage points make it sound better in this case.
Less bad, yeah.
But what we have here is a good old-fashioned sell-off that's happening at the moment. And certainly I think that you can say the spark that is currently precipitating it is the concern about the Chinese real estate landowner company Evergrande, who I'm guessing most of you hadn't heard of prior to the last week or two.
Yep.
But if you've in fact been listening to this show, you'll note that we actually talked about it back in June of this year. And so once again, I continue to believe that the Financial Exchange is on the cutting edge when it comes to telling you tomorrow's stories.
Today.
Yesterday.
Yeah.
Yesterday.
Okay.
Not even today. Yesterday. So here's what we've got going on. Evergrande is a behemoth in the Chinese real estate market. It is just a monster, has over $300 billion in outstanding liabilities, and the stock is just absolutely cratering and pretty much bringing the entire Chinese real estate sector down with it in terms of valuations.
And it's starting to seep into, I think this is another differentiator, is that it's starting to seep into other sectors of the Chinese market where you've got, you know, basically anybody that has any loans outstanding anywhere is seeing a hit to their stock price. There was an insurance company that was taking a hit. Anybody that could see, you know, downstream impact from Evergrande defaulting is feeling it in their stock price.
Well, and it's not just in China that you're starting to see pressure in financials. You've got Deutsche Bank off 6% today. UBS is off 5%. So the European banks are getting whacked pretty solidly on this as well. And you're seeing a little bit of an issue with U.S. banks, you know, that obviously, you know, have some interconnected relationships here. But, you know, this is obviously going to be the big question is how does China deal with this and how do they try to make it such that this is not a systemic issue? And in fact, let's talk a little bit about how Evergrande got to this point, because I think it's important to recognize what's taken them here. About a year or so ago, the Chinese government unveiled what they called their three red lines policy for residential investment. And more or less, the Chinese government realized, hey, we've been, you know, spending too much money building a whole bunch of residential investment that we don't honestly need. We talked last week about the 15-building complex that was demolished, quite literally, because it had been unfilled for the last 8 years.
Yeah, it turned out that one-child policy worked about as well as expected.
And so the Chinese government last year put in this three-red-line policy, which were three restrictions on Chinese real estate companies as to the amount of leverage they could have and so on and so forth, with the idea that, hey, if we stop this now, we can prevent this from getting to a point where these are truly creating systemic risk to the financial health of our overall system. And instead, while it may be very painful to deal with this, at least it's not going to blow up the entire world if we, you know, if some of these companies struggle or even go out of business. So this is what I would call a controlled demolition of the Chinese real estate sector, both literally and figuratively. That is what you have going on right now. The question that every single person is asking, if you go on Twitter or if you text me, which don't, but if you text me, you get the question, is this, you know, Lehman Brothers all over again? Yeah. Are we heading to global financial crisis 2.0?
Those are the comparisons that continue to get made over and over and over again. So definitely important to compare and contrast.
Two major differences. The first is when you talk about the Chinese real estate sector, you cannot do so without talking about the Chinese government. And in saying that, it is a vastly different scenario than what we had in the United States, simply because for all the talk about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and yada yada and, you know, U.S. Yeah. government support for the U.S. real estate sector, it's at a whole different level of tie-in when it comes to what's going on in China. And
because we're talking about things like land grants, like severely subsidized loans or even direct investment.
Yes, it's not just, hey, the implicit backing of mortgage-backed securities. Right. It's, no, we're the Chinese government is directing, we're going to give X parcels to this company at this price, and X, it's a very different world there. So I think that's the first thing to understand. The second is, if China wanted to truly rescue and bail out Evergrande, they would have done so already. Okay, so they are not simply going to let them get to the precipice of going out of business and then say, hey guys, everything's fine. So I do think we need to understand that it's almost by design that China is letting this company fail. They have an interest payment today that they're not making on a bond. They got another on Thursday yep. that they're guiding that they're likely not going to make. And again, when you have real estate companies defaulting, that's typically not good. Other things, and again, this is on a scale from 1 to 10. I'm like a 4.5 in terms of my specific knowledge on all this, but I've read enough about this to be dangerous. With many contracts in China, often the suppliers are not necessarily paid in cash, but rather in short-term commercial paper. So again, this is one of the risks that you do have, is that if you are a steel supplier, if you are an iron ore supplier, if you are a company supplying drywall, you are not typically paid in yuan. You're not typically paid in dollars. You're paid in short-term loans that, okay, we'll take this because it's easier for us to own and collateralize, and then we could always pass it off. So there's a lot of short-term commercial paper flowing around that may be worth nothing. And so you do have a risk of contagion when it comes to Chinese suppliers to the construction industry.
Right.
Which is nerve-wracking. It's again, this is,
so you're basically saying that there are suppliers of raw material and different products, even potentially labor, that are holding additional short-term debt of Evergrande, and if Evergrande defaults, then those
they
suppliers
don't get paid, and then they can't pay their workers, right. And they may end up going out of business. And so you do have a contagion issue when it comes to China. Why does this matter to the United States, you might ask? Well, obviously, it's a world interconnected financial system. Sure. I mentioned Evergrande's got, you know, $300 billion in liabilities, only about $19 billion held outside of mainland China. So it's not something where there's a ton of exposure, but obviously you got European banks that always love to get into this stuff. You got some American banks that likely have some exposure, and that's without getting into the other parts of the Chinese high yield market where there clearly is some exposure amongst U.S. financials and hedge funds and so on down the line. So this is why you end up in a situation where Chinese markets, mainland markets, I believe are closed today and tomorrow. They're not going to open until Wednesday, interestingly enough. But the Hang Seng Index, which is based in Hong Kong, down over 3% today. When I went to bed, it was actually down 4.5%, so that's actually an improvement overnight. You've got Europe also going through a big sell-off. The DAX is off 2.25%. The FTSE is off 1%. So you got, you know, sell-offs spilling over there overnight. And then as we talked at the open, you've got U.S. markets down as well. So is this a Lehman moment where we head to systemic financial crisis? Unlikely. Okay, but that doesn't mean that it can't be very painful in the short term. Remember, when we're talking about Lehman Brothers and the great financial crisis, we're talking about stocks selling off 50%
yep.
from their highs. There's a lot of room between a 4% dip that we've seen to this point and a 50% Lehman Brothers-esque dip. You could very easily say, hey, we have a 10 to 20% sell-off that we go into.
You're talking about here domestically.
Yes.
Because I do think it's possible you see a 50% sell-off in areas of the Chinese market. I mean, some of them have already sold off 50%, but, you know, depending on when and where the Chinese government decides to step in, because I'm sure we'll get there. I'm sure that's the next piece here. But I could see, you know, severe market drops in Chinese markets.
And that is the question here when it comes to where does this go? Because while you might not have a Lehman Brothers-esque crisis, okay, anyone who's old enough to remember the 1990s, so you had to be born in, 1980 or later.
Hmm.
Most of our listeners, earlier. Okay? Yeah. 1980 earlier, yeah. Sorry. Most of our listeners probably remember the 1997 currency crisis that was effectively the death knell for long-term capital management. Similar part of the world, similar potential issue with a different cause here, but let's take a break and then we'll talk about next potential steps and how this may reverberate over the next year or two when we come back.
Wall Street Watch, a full update on the market's performance to date. Weekdays at 10:30, only here on the Financial Exchange Radio Network.
When it comes to putting together a retirement plan, one of the first things you need to figure out is where you're going to live. Hi, this is Chuck Zotta from the Armstrong Advisory Group, and the decision about where to live once you retire will largely set the tone for the rest of your retirement strategy. Your location will largely determine your cost of living, the amount of taxes you'll pay, and your access to quality healthcare services. Real estate taxes can be a major burden or just a small inconvenience. If you plan on moving to a different state, it's important to know how that state taxes income and include a plan to cover your tax bill in your broader retirement strategy. This is just one area that we cover in this month's new free guide, Developing a Retirement Plan. Get your free copy of this must-have guide today by calling 800-393-4001. That's 800-393-4001. And you can also download this guide right now at armstrongadvisory.com.
Securities offered through Securities America Incorporated. Member FINRA SIPC. And advisory services offered through Securities America Advisors Incorporated. Charles Zotta, representative. Armstrong Advisory Group and the Securities America companies are unaffiliated.
The DAV 5K, proudly presented by Encore Boston Harbor, is Saturday, November 6th. This year, we all finish in the Ford. To register for the DAV 5K and support the Disabled American Veterans of Massachusetts, visit DAV5K.Boston. That's DAV5K.Boston.
This segment of the Financial Exchange is brought to you in part by Southern Airways Express. Book your flight to Nantucket today with a brand new schedule from Hanscom Field off Route 128. If you live north or west of Boston, or in southern New Hampshire or Maine, Hanscom Field is the hassle-free way for you to get to Nantucket. Southern Airways Express, fast flights, low fares. Book today at iFlySouthern.com.
Last segment, we were talking about the situation with Evergrande and the rest of Chinese markets, and I made the comment towards the end of the segment. What's ultimately going to determine the next couple of legs here is going to be what the policy response is from China. To this point, it's been fairly minimal. At some point, they are likely going to step in some way, shape, or form. But I likened back to the 1997 Asian financial crisis, which was pretty much a situation where you had just a complete blow up in Asian currencies rather quickly, and ultimately resulted in the blowing up of long-term capital management. The LTCM crisis, as it's known in the industry, is pretty much an example of what happens when you have no risk management, is the best way that I can put it. And ultimately, the piece that you come back to with that Asian financial crisis in 1997 was that while it did spark a significant downturn in markets, not just overseas, but also domestically in the United States, you did see actually both major indices at the time, the Dow and the S&P, actually finished the year up for the year after significant drops. The Dow, as an example, fell 7.2% in a single day on October 27th, 1997, but still finished the day positively, still finished the year positively, despite falling 12% during that crisis. And it was largely because the economies at the time in the region said, okay, we need to go all out towards additional stimulus, and you got, you know, additional responses from the U.S. government as well. and you ended up with another 2 years of the tech bubble before things finally burst for the final time. So do you end up with that scenario? Maybe. Do you end up with just a slow bleed, which, again, it's a quick one in terms of the real estate companies in China? I mean, you have other ones that in similar situations that have lost 80% in the last week now.
Yeah, of their stock value. Yep.
And so it's going to be very, very messy over the next few months. And I think the guidance that I give to people is, if you are not a trader, and remember, a trader is someone who is different from an investor. The terms get used interchangeably, yep. But if you are not a trader, don't even bother. Don't even bother. Don't even try to do anything, because you are going to get absolutely whipsawed because you don't understand how the Australian dollar fits with, you know, what's going on in Asian markets. You don't understand why, you know, you don't have a good enough conception of what levers the Chinese government can actually pull and at what impact they actually have. So if you are not a trader who understands these foreign markets, don't even bother. That's my message. And I know that sounds kind of helpless, but it's, again, if you are an investor who's in for the long term and not someone who trades and understands these specific issues, don't bother. That's my message.
Yeah, I think the other message, though, is understanding what you actually have exposure to. There's so many people that I talk to that, I mean, Chuck, how many people have you spoken to about their portfolios and you put an analysis in front of them and they say, Wow, I had no idea that I had that much China exposure or just overseas exposure in general.
Yep.
And so, yeah, to that end, this is not me telling you what to do other than to understand what you own, because so many times people have just been absolutely shocked. Like the 2050, you know, Fidelity Retirement Fund has nearly half of its equity exposure overseas. I was not generally aware of that, and most people wouldn't be. Doesn't necessarily mean do anything, but understand what you own when it comes to especially moments like this.
And, you know, I hear so often from people this idea, hey, emerging markets are where the growth is. You know, that's where you got to go for growth. That's how you grow the portfolio for the long term. Am I wrong that I hear that from people all the time?
Very often.
So I've got the two major emerging markets ETFs that I have sitting in front of me right now. Since October of 2007, the iShares version has gone from $54 per share down to $50.
Since 2007?
Since 2007. So in the last 14 years, if you own the iShares Emerging Market ETF, you lost almost 10%. By comparison, okay, the S&P 500 over that time, despite going through a financial crisis in the meantime and everything, is up more than 200%.
Yeah.
Okay. The Vanguard version of it, okay, you go back once again to October of 2007, was trading at $56 a share. It's $49 today.
So what is the, I think I've got a lesson to draw out of that, but what's your lesson there? My lesson would be, economies are not stock markets. I think it'd be tough to argue that the Chinese economy has not grown and developed since 2007.
It's grown faster than anywhere in the world. That's a major market.
That doesn't mean that the stock market is going to grow with it.
No.
And granted, we're looking at emerging markets, which includes, you know, parts of Africa, all sorts of
areas.
These
are mostly China, though.
But yeah, it's largely China. And differentiating that, separating that in your mind to understand that the stock market is not the economy is not the stock market, and neither are politics, is really important when it comes to managing money.
My big lesson is don't get sucked into the story of why you're being sold an investment. Understand what's actually going on under the hood. Because these emerging markets funds, you want to know why these you want to know why iShares loves these funds and why Vanguard does? Because they get to charge more than they do on domestic ones. They get to charge more. And Vanguard's got $74 billion in the ETF version of their emerging markets fund. If that were just sitting in the S&P 500, what's the Vanguard S&P 500 cost these days?
5 basis points? Let me take a look.
Five?
Yeah, let's call it 5. I don't have the... I can't find it right now.
The emerging markets one from Vanguard? It's double that.
Yeah.
And the performance obviously does not justify it. So understand what it is that you're actually buying. It's not just, oh, I'm buying, you know, 7% GDP growth in China. If that were the case, this would have outperformed the U.S. markets.
It was 3 basis points.
By the way. Three. So this 3X. Is 3 times as expensive. Understand what it is that you're buying and why it fits into your portfolio. Don't just buy the story of, hey, that's where the growth is, so I got to invest there. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we've got Wall Street Watch.
Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at TFE Show. Breaking business news is always first, right here on the Financial Exchange Radio Network. Time now for Wall Street Watch, a complete look at what's moving markets so far today, right here on the Financial Exchange Radio Network.
It is time now for Wall Street Watch. We're joined by Emma David from the Armstrong Advisory Group, who has the distinct pleasure of telling us just how bad markets look this morning. Emma, thanks for coming on.
It's quite the pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So how are things looking?
It's pretty ugly out there. We're seeing the conversation from investors temporarily shifting away from COVID and inflation this morning and onto China's property market. As well as some concerns over the soaring natural gas prices in Europe and the some of the talks around Federal Reserve scaling back stimulus. But really, China being the main concern there, we've got the Dow down 1.5%, S&P down 1.5%, NASDAQ is down this morning 2%, and the Russell 2000 down 2.25%, with the VIX now, which is the volatility index, climbing up over 20%. So just a flight to safety this morning, and we are seeing the dollar stronger, treasury yield slipping, and oil prices heavily dropping as well.
And so you, the eternal optimist, went out there and found, what, like 1 of 8 companies that are positive today for the S&P 500? What's the story with Colgate-Palmolive?
That's exactly what I did. A little speck of green in the Red Sea today with consumer goods company Colgate-Palmolive is up 0.4% on support from Deutsche Bank analysts from for the New York-based company. They're giving it an upgrade from hold to buy and giving it a higher price target from $84 a share to $86 a share. Deutsche analysts are basically saying that investors are not really seeing the forest from the trees with this company, Colgate-Palmolive, and that it's being punished, which it's down 10% this year in a year in which the S&P 500 is down nearly 20%. So certainly being punished in the short term here with some headwinds like inflation on their cost of goods as well as supply chain hardships. The analysts, however, are saying that the company over the long term has positioned itself for a turnaround story and has become more sustainable with some of its brand initiatives, such as creating packaging from recycled material.
It's Emma David from the Armstrong Advisory Group joining us for Wall Street Watch, in particular today, taking a look at Colgate-Palmolive. Up about 0.5% on the news that the Deutsche Bank analyst gave some positive outlook for the stock. Deutsche Bank, by the way, off 7% today. Thank you, Emma.
Thanks, Mike.
One last rather disturbing story from the Evergrande saga that is unfolding in China. When they were looking for cash earlier this year, they went to their own employees and said, if you want to keep your bonus, you have to lend us cash. You think that would fly over here?
God, I hope not.
You think that would fly over here?
No. No, you'd have the SEC breathing down your neck the next hour.
And this is also something that is very unseemly, given the stories that are now coming out about insiders cashing out significant amounts of money from the company, as well as the fact that there are a ton of families that use the Chinese property market, and there's a ton of investment products, including some sponsored by Evergrande, that have popped up in the Chinese investment market. That basically are going to have these investments wiped out, yeah. if not completely, almost entirely. And so the fact that you have investors being wiped out, employees being told, hey, lend us cash if you want to keep your bonus, while you have insiders cashing out massive packages. On one level, at least it's nice to know that this stuff, that there's corruption outside the
Green
U.S.
corruption everywhere.
Yes, it's not just airline CEOs.
Yeah. Yeah, and in China, you know, here in the United States, they'd be slapped with a fine for doing it. In China, we'll probably never hear from them again.
From what perspective?
Those CEOs, I mean...
Depends how connected they are.
Yeah, it does.
Either way, you might just never hear about it again. It might be, okay, this person is gone and they're not going to hold any role like that again. Or it's, hey, they did this and no one cares. You know, that it depends how connected you are, I think, when you look at these types of stories.
To what degree are you an arm of the Chinese Communist Party?
Earnings alarm bells ringing for market showing signs of fatigue. So, I'm not quite... buying this here at this point.
Yeah.
Here's what happened is you have a significant number of companies that have said we're not going to be able to meet our previously guided profits, including a couple weeks ago you had two paint companies, PPG and Sherwin-Williams, both issue earnings, negative earnings guidance. Because, interestingly enough, to paint companies, because of the semiconductor shortage, they said we don't have enough chips to run the machines that we use to make the paint, and so we're not going to be able to make the deliveries that we thought we would. Again, the semiconductor shortage now affecting paint companies. And so I think that while it is true that you do have, you know, a number of companies that fall into this category, it's also something where, from my perspective, I continue to think there is this underestimation of earnings growth that we have seen dating back a couple quarters now, and especially in service-heavy sectors that are not affected by these types of shortages. It's hard for me to sit there and say, gee, Marriott's going to have a problem with quarterly earnings because of this. That might be a short-term thing because of Delta, but they don't have a semiconductor shortage leading to not enough rooms. The rooms are already built.
Yeah, and... assuming you see that massive spend and investment and return in those sectors, I'm with you. And yes, there's a massive semiconductor issue, but it's not like we are producing fewer total semiconductors in the world, and it's not like demand for them has increased 100% year over year. But stories like this are the ones that I think have some investors spooked about a stagflation story, right? If you're looking for evidence of this story that, hey, the economy is going to come to a screeching halt and you're going to continue to see inflation like you did in the 1970s, back in the 70s, caused by the oil embargo and the crisis there. Today, we don't have an embargo, but we do have a massive shortage, at least right now, of semiconductors, and it's impacting areas of the economy that we wouldn't have expected it to impact. But so far, you know, big differences, not impacting employment one bit. Companies,
nope.
You know, I'm sure that Sherwin-Williams still has thousands of job openings that they are desperate to hire for and are still finding ways to make money. So perhaps a slowdown from previously estimated very, very high growth to just very high growth. Yes, stagflation, I'm still not buying it. But this is the evidence that people are pointing towards and perhaps, you know, adding fuel to the fire of markets turning down through the month of September.
Couple stories with regards to the COVID-19 situation in the United States. First, early this morning, I think it was around 6:45 or 7, Pfizer putting out a press release that their COVID vaccine tested in a smaller dose than what they've used for adults and teens did provoke a strong immune response in children aged 5 to 11. They've guided that they are anticipating submitting this to the FDA for an emergency use authorization as soon as possible, likely later this week or early next week, mm-hmm. which then, based on previous timelines for EUAs going into effect, puts us probably into early to mid-November at the earliest in terms of this COVID vaccine being available for ages 5 to 11. Having said that, the FDA has generally erred more cautiously with regards to children. In fact, asking Pfizer to double the size of their age 5 to 11 test group over the course of the summer. And so I do wonder if maybe there's a little bit longer process here, but it strikes me as any time from early November to early December is the window at which you would expect approval of this for ages 5 to 11.
Yeah. So that's where we're looking at in terms of a timeline there. I don't think a whole lot to add there. Separately, the FDA Advisory Board has overwhelmingly, I guess, decided to not support general third doses of vaccines for all individuals. They have said that injections for people 65 and older or at high risk of severe disease should possibly receive those third doses, but for the general population, not seeing enough data at this point.
So I'm going to be a little bit critical of the FDA on this, not for not approving it for the general public, but they also carved out a provision for workers in high risk occupations. And they then had a member of the committee go around and tour all of the press shows yesterday about this. And they said, well, what qualifies is, a high-risk position. And it could be someone in a grocery store, a teacher, because, teachers are around a bunch of unvaccinated students. Mm-hmm. And they even said, look, parents could qualify as someone who's in a high-risk position because their children would be unable to get vaccinated before, this Pfizer announcement. And so it's just very wishy-washy about, well, do you want to approve this for the general public for a third dose or do you not? Because if you're just going to say, hey, being a parent is a high-risk occupation, well, then why not just approve it for everyone? What are we really doing here? And so I am going to be critical because, honestly, the FDA, I think, has just had its head in the sand for the better part of the last 2 years on some of this stuff now with how they've handled it and how they've tried to communicate clearly on these issues. And quite honestly, it's fairly embarrassing how they've, hemmed and hawed over the last couple of weeks and still not come to a clear conclusion at this point about what they want to do. If you're saying, well, we won't approve it for the general public, but we'll approve it for parents.
What does that even mean?
So if it's someone without kids, they shouldn't get it? Because is it riskier if you don't have kids? Because it makes no sense.
I take the point that there have been studies that have shown that people that are constantly around higher concentrations of COVID, like nurses, are a very good example here. Yeah, I mean, my kids going to school and getting exposed to other children, I don't understand it. I don't have a real firm understanding of what they're doing here.
The other piece that I'm quite honestly a little bit, I'm upset about it. I am upset about it, actually. The FDA has one job. Is this safe and does it do what it's supposed to do? That's how they're supposed to evaluate whether or not they approve a drug. Am I breaking any crazy new ground on this?
No, I don't think so.
Is it safe and does it do what it's supposed to do? Given that, why is the FDA referencing, well, we want to make sure that everyone in the world can have enough access to these before we approve? That's not what your job is.
Yeah.
That's not what your job is to make sure that everyone else has access to vaccines. If Pfizer wants to figure out how to spool up more capacity, they can figure out how to do that and they'll make more money. But the FDA's job is not to ensure that everyone in the world has equal access to drugs. It's to approve based on the efficacy and the safety of the drug.
If the president wants to make a decision around that, then so be it. But your job is to advise the president on those two factors.
So that's the stuff that bothers me about how they're looking at the situation. Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we have an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal from Janet Yellen. I'm not familiar with her, but she wrote this op-ed about the debt ceiling, and so we'll have a little bit of talk about this op-ed from a Janet Yellen right after this.
Breaking business and financial news first throughout the day. Only here on the Financial Exchange Radio Network.
We've talked a lot about our relationship with Stony Brook Water over the past year. As business owners, we know the challenges of making a budget, and believe it or not, having large jugs of water as well as bottled water in all of our offices across New England became quite costly. We wanted to provide quality to our employees in every way, shape, and form. And once we learned how a new Ion cooler from Stony Brook Water could help us save money while also providing a superior product, we were sold. If you run a business and are spending hundreds of dollars a month on bottled water or those massive 5-gallon jugs, it's time for you to make a change. Let the guys at Stony Brook explain how their deals work. You'll be able to offer your workers the best tasting, purest water around, but you'll also be able to eliminate a burdensome cost. It's not getting less expensive to run a business in spite of the economic recovery, so you'll want to continue to save where you can. Stony Brook Water can help. Call them today at 978-381-1476. That's 978-381-1476. Or you can visit them online at stonybrookwater.com. Stony Brook Water. Water the way it should be.
If the Wall Street roller coaster has you scratching your head, check out our brand new podcast, Dumb Questions for Smart Money, an easy way to gain some knowledge about the latest trends in the business and financial industry without the brain pain that comes with it. Listen and learn to Dumb Questions for Smart Money. Subscribe today on Apple, Spotify, and all your favorite podcast apps.
So I read the Wall Street Journal every morning, and I found this in the op-ed section from a new writer who I wasn't familiar with. Her name is Janet Yellen.
Is that and, how you pronounce it?
Well, the Janet or the Yellen? You think it's Janae?
Yeah, so clearly former Fed chair and current Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has some work on her plate right now. The all-important debt ceiling is looming, and they never give an official date because nobody knows exactly when the government would be unable to fund its current expenditures. But sometime in October, in all likelihood, the Treasury Department's cash balance will fall to an insufficient level, and the federal government will be unable to pay its bills, which has quite literally never happened. We've had this debt ceiling in place for over 100 years. It's been raised 80 times just in the last 60 years, I believe. And once again, it will be raised. I have no genuine concern about defaulting on our debt. But once again, we're going to draw it out till the last second and draw up a big fight over something that, quite frankly, should not be.
It's so preposterous that the Treasury Secretary of the United States of America has to write an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal telling Congress to raise the debt limit for spending it's already approved. This is the worst part of it, is this idea of, oh, we can't raise the debt limit because then, like, we'll have too much debt. You've already approved the spending, dummies. You've already approved the spending. The budget has already gone forward. You've already done this. And people say, well, yes, they have to pass another continuing resolution by the end of September in order to fund the government. But you really don't think they're going to do that? What are we talking about? The Treasury Secretary of the United States of America is spending her time writing op-eds so that Congress can raise the debt limit for spending it's already approved.
So the argument being made by Mitch McConnell is the Democrats are trying to push through $3.5 trillion of additional spending. We disagree with that, so we aren't going to vote to raise the debt limit. They can do it on their own via reconciliation, which, to my knowledge, is true.
They can do it.
They can do it on their own. I think it's an unreasonable position, given that Democrats voted for an increase in the debt ceiling when the Republican majority voted for increased spending with tax cuts just in 2017, dramatically increased the deficit for those tax cuts.
And last year we had $7 trillion in spending authorized by Congress,
right,
and there was no trouble raising the debt ceiling then.
Right. So my point is, as always, politicians are full of stuff that I can't talk about on the radio. I understand why they're doing it. It'll absolutely play well with their constituents when they go to the ballot box. God, sooner than I would even like to talk about. But it's a false narrative. It's a false argument. You're not being fiscally conservative by voting against increasing the debt limits. You are just playing politics. That's all it is. That's all it is.
Ridiculous. It really is the dumbest rule.
Yeah,
I struggle to find a dumber piece of legislation at the federal level. States have them. I mean, we've talked about the states where it's like illegal to, you know, throw a chicken over a wall,
sure,
and stuff like that.
Yeah, but while those are dumb, they are not impactful.
No, exactly. You know,
like, this has the combination of being really, really stupid and massively impactful to the,
right,
global economy.
Because we talked last week. about frozen lasagna and the required meat content in frozen lasagna from the USDA.
Oh, I missed that conversation.
Oh, you weren't here for that day?
Either I was zoning out or I wasn't here. I'm not sure.
I wasn't here for that either.
Well, what's the difference? Ultimately, no one cares. It doesn't affect anyone if there's 11% or 12% meat in a frozen lasagna. This is something that is so stupid and yet so front and center. It just...
it's painful.
It's awful. But that's why the Treasury Secretary of the United States of America has to write an op-ed to the Wall Street Journal telling Congress to do its job to approve spending, to approve a debt limit increase for spending it already approved.
There we go.
Whew. We're done with hour number one. Hour number two is going to be much more upbeat. Make sure you join us. It's going to be fantastic in just a little bit.